Hello and welcome to the CAAV podcast. Once again, I'm joined by Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV. And today we're going to be talking through and giving our listeners a practical overview of devolution. Devolution, of course, has happened in the UK and is something possibly people have become more aware of in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's opportune for us now to chat through some of the practicalities of devolution. Jeremy, where do you want to begin? Do you want to give us a quick overview of where we are?
Yes. I mean, devolution, as you say, has come to the fore with COVID, but it's also come to the fore very much with the discovery of the level of control that each of the separate parts of the United Kingdom have over agricultural and environmental policies in their own areas, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland. And once the European Union has been removed, and that there isn't, in that sense, a central UK policy to be delivered. And that is a moment when we can take stock of where we are. We have different legislation, different patterns of devolution, different histories for devolution in each of the three areas. And in many ways, it's easy to overlook the extent to which devolution has happened for many of the things that affect people in their ordinary lives. As I've mentioned, devolution across environmental and agricultural policies, devolution across planning and land control, devolution across housing, devolution across a whole swathe of areas that mean that things will be different, because perhaps a basic observation to make is that the point of devolution is that things will be different between different parts of the United Kingdom. Devolution was undertaken in response to political needs, but also it allows, as we see with the different states in America, it allows different experimentation to see what works and what doesn't. Interesting examples, again, to share experiences and take matters forward. And so very much responding to local circumstances. And that's then is a continuing and an evolving program. So there's a lot in this, and people tending obviously to live in their own particular part of the United Kingdom, don't necessarily see the scale of change that we've undertaken in the last 25 years particularly.
And it's interesting that I'm sure there are many common issues across the devolved administrations and possibly different policy solutions. From the CAV perspective, you have an oversight of all the various policies being discussed and consulted and implemented across the UK. Does that give you an indication and more experiences of what's worked elsewhere? Is it a better breeding ground for ideas?
Well, it's something certainly that as a UK-wide association, talking with all the governments and with those in each of the four parts of the United Kingdom, we're better able to do than many in that sort of compare and contrast. This was tried. There were reasons why it didn't work. You're probably better advised not to try it. Or here is a different way in which that was done and it worked. So take a look at whether it answers here. But of course, you are, for example, if we're looking at agriculture, you're dealing with very different geographies, very different climates in that sense. You know, a greater predominance of uplands in Wales and in Scotland as issues. You're dealing with a very much larger area of arable land within England, but also significant areas in Scotland. You're dealing with, again, different patterns of how policy has developed. So it's that mix between, if you like, an absolutely rational approach as to what does and doesn't work and working with the frameworks and structures on the ground.
And the fact that the devolved administrations now have full control over agricultural and environmental policy is, of course, a consequence of Brexit.
Yes, absolutely. We did devolution when we did devolution for Scotland and Wales. We did it very much within the framework of the European Union, the European Union's single market, the European Union's common agricultural policy, and its developing programme for environmental policy. Stripping that away, as has happened with Brexit, has meant that those powers don't come back to the United Kingdom, but they actually sit just the more fully without that strain of a European framework to try and work within the regulation of European auditors and so on. It comes back to each of the four parts of the United Kingdom, determining how they want to take forward the legacy schemes from the European Union, how they wish to move forward in developing schemes that suit them rather than designed within a European framework. And that is something that was, I think, not expected, possibly even by the devolved governments themselves, as Brexit was under discussion. They have been remarkable winners from the move in terms of their control over agricultural and environmental policies.
So shall we now take a look at each of the devolved areas? And where do you want to begin, Jeremy?
Well, let's start with Scotland. Scotland had its own parliament until 1707. The crowns were united in 1603. The Scottish Parliament was dissolved and became part of Westminster, but retained very significant, as part of the deal for the Act of Union, retained very significant Scottish institutions, then the very important Kirk, the Presbyterian Church, but also education and law. And so the framework of Scottish law has continued with its separate court structure, and that has meant a very significant difference in things, a certain amount of different Scottish legislation following that coming through down the centuries. It's administrative devolution to Scotland then flowed in the 20th century, and then formal legislative devolution, the creation of first the Scottish Assembly, now the Scottish Parliament, happened with legislation in the end of the 1990s. And that gave the Scottish Parliament powers to make acts and statutory instruments from the beginning as a single chamber parliament, and the Scottish government inheriting the powers in the main of the Scottish office and many from Westminster in terms of making those powers. From the start, the Scottish government and parliament have had all powers except those that Westminster held back. So again, following that pattern from 1707, a very wide sweep of powers across large areas of policy, but with issues around most taxes, obviously international trade, defence, quite a lot of energy policy, the management of markets and so on, all of that remains at UK level. But below that, most of the things that affect people's lives are actually now a matter for Scottish legislation.
And what do you make of Scotland's use of those powers?
Well, we've seen this used to quite some significant effect, and indeed Scotland looking to use its constitutional position not to share in UK legislation, but to run its own parallel legislation. We've seen this very much with the development of post-Brexit agricultural policy and environmental policy, where Scotland has developed separate institutions. On agricultural policy, unlike Wales and Northern Ireland, it didn't share in the Agriculture Act 2020, but as is perfectly within its rights, delivered its own agricultural statute and will continue to develop that. It's made its own changes, as the other devolveds have, to inherited European law in this area. Scotland is very distinctively delivering a programme of successive land reform statutes, and we now have a consultation for further changes to management of large estates and other issues around the control and management of land. And so we have seen those measures bear very directly on Scottish rural land management and life.
Now, let's turn our attention to Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland has a very different history for this purpose. There was originally an All-Ireland Parliament in Dublin until 1801 for reasons to do with Catholic emancipation. That dissolved itself on the grounds that these issues could be better handled within the larger framework of the UK rather than the specific context of Ireland. And you then have legislation settled there by Westminster with Irish members of Parliament through until the early 1920s. Irish independence took the Republic one way, and devolution to the Stormont Parliament in Northern Ireland took Northern Ireland another way, with a very strong pattern of devolution to the six counties and the Stormont Parliament. And they have been legislating for themselves ever since 1921. That continues now. There have been periods when there was direct rule, but again, that was done more by order in council and less by direct legislation from Westminster. The separate operation of government in Northern Ireland and has been a very distinct feature of the United Kingdom Constitution for that period. Yes, so this means that agricultural policy has, for example, been a function of the Northern Irish government from the start, and we're now seeing that being developed with its own proposals, agricultural and environmental, for the coming years in response to its new independence at this point. A particular factor bearing on Northern Ireland is that it steers something of a course between where the general policies of the rest of the United Kingdom go and where the policies of the Irish Republic go. And so, for example, in terms of phasing the rates of basic payment to standard levels, England had already done it. Wales and Scotland took 5 years to do it. The Irish Republic chose 10. Northern Ireland found it most pragmatic to adopt 7. And there are a number of other areas where the cross-influence of different markets drive some need for the Northern Irish government to steer policy so that it runs a course between the Republic on the one side and Great Britain on the other.
And what's the position in Wales?
Wales has a timetable closer to Scotland. Wales was brought very much within the structure of government in England under Henry VIII, and obviously an earlier medieval history. It developed a administrative devolution really from the 1960s, and then by a very, very narrow margin in the referendum on devolution, gained legislative devolution at the end of the 1990s. That was initially just for statutory instruments, not statutes of parliament. That was then granted to it from 2006. So it has progressively gained more powers as it has found its feet and developed an appetite for using them. And now we have the position that it has a wider control of powers. It can make, therefore, this is why it can make statutes that amend the Agricultural Holdings Act, for example, why it will have a different approach perhaps on environmental impact assessments. It explains why now it has, with its limited taxation powers, like Scotland, it has developed a land transactions tax rather than staying with stamp duty land tax. And these are all powers that the Welsh Parliament, the Senedd as it's now called, has to manage its affairs.
And having spoken about Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, where is the devolution in England?
This is an interesting and an obscure picture, and perhaps in some years' time we will know what we have done. At the same time as devolution was being discussed and voted on for Wales and Scotland, so proposals were being brought forward for devolution to regional assemblies in England, and the one that came forward earliest for the North East was convincingly defeated in a referendum, and no further appetite was seen for that. However, what has been operating, has been called devolution, has been this growing series of city and regional deals over the last decade and more, where powers have been granted to city areas, larger rural areas sometimes, in conjunction usually with them agreeing to have a mayor or an equivalent post, a single individual carrying responsibility, to coordinate a number of differing policies, and they differ from area to area. Manchester secured control over health and social security. Others do planning and transport. A variety of deals growing as an odd web and indeed spilling out across the borders into other parts of the United Kingdom. A complex geometry further being taken forward by the Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill, with levels of power being devolved, not necessarily particularly funding, though commitments to funding. And what this will look like when it becomes clear really remains to be seen. Rural areas have quite often been uncomfortable with having a mayor. They don't really felt this is appropriate. The unitary creation of a Cornwall council saw it not gain powers over health because it wouldn't have a mayor. But Cambridgeshire and Peterborough have a mayor who is looking energetically to drive forward infrastructure projects. So it's unformed, it's moving, it's not yet clear how beneficial it is. Government is using it to create larger local authorities that may have more effectiveness and competence, perhaps for some of the challenges coming. It is very much a work in progress, and one that's quite hard to categorise.
And it's also very much a mixed picture across the UK, but there still needs to be some common structures and common frameworks, particularly around markets.
Very much so. Obviously, the UK government retains powers over the constitution, it retains power, it retains defence, it retains international trade. And that, of course, has been an interesting area in terms of the trade deals that have been struck recently and the trade arrangement with the European Union. It looks to maintain for most taxes a level of commonality of taxation. And that's part of, then, as you've mentioned, the critical question of maintaining an internal market. That the European Union had its single market, the UK before that had its single market, and legislation has now been put in place to enable the continuation of an unimpeded single market. Again, one of the challenges out of Brexit was to ensure that there were not accidentally issues created that divided that market, which would be particularly to the disadvantage of the smaller economies and the devolved nations. You can see this, for example, in Canada, or indeed in parts of the United States, but Canada, where the provinces came together to form the Federation and have their own very different regimes that have not been significantly harmonised, so that there are significant trading issues, licences for dentists, standards for tyres and the rest that vary between the provinces, and an anxiety to avoid that here within the United Kingdom. That, of course, though, creates some conflicts with the powers of each devolved authority to set its own standards on things like consumer protection or whatever it might be. And those are issues that are having to be talked through and worked through and understood as we move on. An interesting example of that is the government taking forward for England proposals for gene editing. Much of gene editing work being developed in Scottish institutions like Rosslyn and SASA. There at the moment being a position in Scotland that it would not wish to have gene editing. We've seen potentially differing attitudes over fracking. We've seen other things. These are areas where we're all going to have to learn how to manage these issues as part of moving forward. But dividing the UK economy would leave a poorer economy. And one of the things that we have seen is the difficulties in supplying small markets. The present issues over the Northern Ireland Protocol raise issues about the supply there, for example, of veterinary medicines, for which the market may be too small to be attractive for many companies. And indeed, possibly the whole market in Ireland may be too small to attract some companies. And that's an interesting challenge that we have to work through in order to ensure the greatest access to the widest quantity of supplies and services for all our people.
How has taxation been handled by devolution?
Well, this exposes some of the very interesting tensions in all of this. The main UK taxes, particularly the capital taxes, have remained at UK level. However, an exception has been made for parts of income tax. So Scotland particularly has some control, Scotland has control over a fraction of income tax that it can then vary. And it has done that in a very token way, creating a nominal 19% rate on a small band of lower income, but then creating a higher band at 21% just to balance it all out. It has used that power more to keep the thresholds for tax rates at earlier levels rather than increasing them as had been happening in for the rest of the UK. So it has used its tax powers to a limited extent on income tax. VAT remains a common UK tax. We have taxes that have been fully devolved. There are minor ones like perhaps the aggregates levy and landfill tax, but we do very much have the taxation of land transactions. And so it is only England and Northern Ireland that now retain SDLT, stamp duty land tax. Scotland developed its land and buildings transactions tax. Relatively similar, but different enough for it to matter. And Wales, then, its land transactions tax. And so they established their own rates, their own ways of assessing, their own routes to liability. And that perhaps is one of the bigger differences when it comes to looking at conveyancing and dealing in property between countries, and one that will be frequently overlooked by somebody in one country thinking of buying a property in one of the other parts of the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland has an outstanding offer on corporation tax, reflecting again its position between Great Britain and the Republic, but the conditions for offering the lower rate of corporation tax that would might attract businesses to Northern Ireland have not been fulfilled, so that sits there. The government is generally very reluctant to devolve more in terms of control of tax, that sort of level, to the devolves, precisely so as not to create distortions within the UK market. But you get to the American question, if I put it that way, the relationship between taxation and representation. The devolves are allocated money that they then spend. Scotland, a limited ability, particularly to raise it from those other taxes and at the margin from income tax, essentially not taken up on income tax. And yet, arguably, a political body is most responsible when it has accountability for the money it raises to meet the tasks it spends. And finding that balance between a UK market and local political responsibility is one of the challenges I think we face in coming times. Rates and local government finance are fully devolved, so that council tax and business rates are a matter in England for Westminster. In Wales, they are a matter for the Welsh government and Senedd. And we now see Wales beginning to consult on a prospective revaluation for council tax. Scotland, again, has council tax and business rates and is doing its revaluation, as in the other parts of the United Kingdom, but on a different original base date. Northern Ireland has retained business rates and also domestic rates, and so operates those differently. And so those remain each under the control of the separate governments.
And perhaps, Jeremy, you could give us a short overview of the differences in agricultural policies or the differences in approach to agricultural policies across the devolved administrations.
Yes, this is a fascinating area. If we take it, in many ways, England very much in the advance in terms of timescale and implementation. All the four governments, one way or another, did a consultation back in 2018. England had Health and Harmony. And that has led on to the Agriculture Act, now in the throes of the Agricultural Transition Plan, to run from 21 to 27, by which time basic payment has gone and the money transferred to a regime of public money for public goods, some support very definitely for productivity, but also for those environmental and other goods in agreements with farmers and landowners. Again, a common regulatory baseline, and you'll see these themes coming through, but expressed differently in different places. Wales, not particularly dissimilar, but caught by reasons of timetabling to start later. We're still waiting on the Welsh legislation. Like England, it has made a significant number of simplifications to the basic payment regime as it's inherited it, to make it more user-friendly and operable on the ground. But we're then looking from 2025 for the introduction of the sustainable farming scheme. Again, agreements, transactions between the state and farmers, making a payment for land management in a particular way, perhaps capital payments for some productivity exercises, and something of a focus on improving business performance, that perhaps completed by the end of the decade. Scotland, a lot of rhetoric about being particularly different, but with a very, very strong driving emphasis in the way Scottish policy is talked about in terms of climate change, very powerful drivers for change linked to that and now to biodiversity, such that we are awaiting the main consultation after the initial stance of stability and simplicity, trying to ease the inherited regime, revive the less favoured area support scheme with its support, hedge support for animals, particularly cattle, and then to move from 24 to a new regime whose shape we see from the programme of government as making at least half the total payments in play from 25 really quite heavily conditional, and that conditionality very largely expected to be around climate change and biodiversity. And so we'll see that again implemented. So that could be an heir to the basic payment, maybe even still called basic payment, maybe still paid largely on area, but with very powerful conditionality for farmers to do things in exchange for the money that would be there, and see how that one works through. Northern Ireland has determined the broad outline of its future. The issue then is implementing it and developing the policy, understood to be largely cross-partisan, again, looking at developing, moving money progressively towards environmental land management and the outcomes that it too needs to deliver for very significant improvements in carbon emissions and adaptation to climate change. Also an emphasis on business productivity, retaining a stabilising payment at a level which the high current rates of basic payment in Northern Ireland can allow, and then developing a number of other angles. But you see there, each of the parts of the UK working within the timetables that they have, the political environments they're in, the pressures they're under, designing different schemes, each actually watching the other a bit to see what's going on. And obviously that makes England a particular object of interest, just to see what might work and what might not, and how it will develop.
And one other area of difference is around residential tenancies and different proposals and regulations being introduced in relation to the letting of residential properties across the four governments.
Yes, because here we're seeing a tide, partly driven by a sense of precariousness among a rising fraction of tenants feeling insecure. So the more often talked about now as renters rather than as tenants, leading to something of a swing back towards more regulation. And watching that come through in the different parts of the United Kingdom is interesting. The first big tide came in Scotland with the Private Tenancies Act of 2016, implemented from 2017, effectively removing the no-fault notice to quit that had been there for shortholds, as Scotland had implemented alongside England. It then expects standards over housing quality, and now we have a major consultation out proposing to make the business of renting out residential properties much more onerous. All this then sits there alongside, as in England and Wales, minimum energy efficiency standards, all making this quite a difficult proposition for many landlords to think about and to wonder. Wales, in the same year, had its Renting Homes Wales Act, but has been very slow to implement that and has now undertaken that this year, such that its provisions should take effect from the 1st of December, with a transition period affecting new agreements thereafter. This turns all agreements into contracts, just calls them contracts, whatever they are for residential lettings, and again expects housing standards, as in Scotland, expects standards as to wiring and smoke alarms and the like, all of which are putting pressure on the electricians' market there at the moment. It retains a no-fault notice to quit, but 6 months notice now rather than two when this comes in. And so along with Northern Ireland remains one of the two parts of the United Kingdom where this is feasible. England, we now have a white paper, long delayed, but prospectively ahead of the Renters Reform Bill later this parliamentary session, removing the Section 21 no-fault notice to quit provision, but proposing a very wide range of grounds and some possible easing of procedures for landlords to regain possession otherwise. So again, we look to wait on that. The final area in Northern Ireland has just had its Private Tenancies Act. Some further regulation, paving the way for the introduction particularly of minimum energy efficiency standards, some regulation of notice to quit periods, but really still a different and more historic structure than you would now see in the three parts of Great Britain. And so each of the parts of the country responding, partly with minimum energy efficiency standards to climate change and carbon issues, but more to a wider sense that people who rent need some further assurance in the marketplace than they've had, but at the jeopardy then, and we're seeing this very clearly, in the falling numbers of properties now available for letting for private occupation. And that is bringing its own further problems with this.
And with the advent of devolution, how has that impacted on local government and local authorities? How do they feel?
Well, I don't think it's necessary for me to say how they feel, but the pattern has been that as what is effectively central government comes nearer to them, so it sits more heavily on them and tends to take more powers and exercise more control over them. In patterns that we've seen certainly in Wales and Scotland. Northern Ireland has more of a history, for other reasons, of wanting to construct local government and has gone through a programme of local government reform, creating new councils and giving them more planning authority than perhaps they had. But in Wales and Scotland, there has been a bit of a pattern of power gravitating to the centre in a way that it wouldn't have done with all authority on most questions lying at Westminster. And that, again, is an interesting tension resulting from devolution.
And as we draw this podcast to a close, Jeremy, I think it's fair to say, is devolution an ongoing journey?
Inevitably. Only to look back over those fragments of history I've quoted show that how people govern themselves, the balance of powers, the challenges they have, the tendency for bodies once created to seek their own life and their own power and their own authority, all these are part of the political constitutional world over the coming generation.
Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV, thank you very much indeed.
And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whichever platform you use. Also, if you've got any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by sending us an email to inquire@caav.org.uk. But that's it for today. Until the next time, thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.